Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Let's take this moment in the increasingly lopsided Democratic race to look ahead and what we might expect in an election campaign between George W. Bush and John F. Kerry. Though it's early to say what the campaign issues will be, it's clear where the two men would like to take the debate. Here's the president on NBC's Meet the Press.
I'm a war president. I make decisions here in the Oval Office in foreign policy matters with war on my mind. And again, I wish it wasn't true, but it is true. And the American people need to know they've got a president who sees the world the way it is. And I see dangers that exist, and it's important for us to deal with them.
John Kerry has moved ahead of his rivals in large part on the strength of his attacks on the Bush foreign policy.
George Bush has made us weaker by overextending the armed forces of the United States, turning the Guards and Reserves into active duty, and driving our allies away and leaving relationships in tatters across this planet. This administration has run the most arrogant, inept, reckless, and ideological foreign policy in the modern history of our country, and we intend to hold them accountable.
The trouble with John Kerry's claim that a substantial number of voters don't believe that the Democratic Party can lead the nation in war and international affairs as well as the Republicans can. This hour, a look at how the Democrats lost their preeminence in foreign policy and what will happen if the same issues are central in this election. Are you one of those more inclined to trust Republicans on matters of security? Will the Democratic Party ever regain the standing it had in times of FDR and Truman? What would a Democratic foreign policy look like to you? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, George Packer and David Brooks are standing by to help us better frame these questions. We wanted to start, though, with the Democratic senator who holds the highest rank in foreign affairs today. Senator Joseph Biden is ranking member on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he's joining us on the line. Senator Biden, thanks for being with us.
Hey, Dick, how are you?
I'm well,
thanks.
Happy
to be with you, although I'm not at all certain I like two such informed people to follow me here.
Well, you're welcome to stick around and defend yourself. You're watching the race.
I have great respect for both of them.
as do we. You're watching the race. Are you encouraged by what you're seeing, either in tone or substance?
I'm encouraged both by tone and substance. But in my experience, I've been here for six presidents. Presidential elections with an incumbent involved tend to be referendums on the president, the sitting president. And I think that's a lot of what you're seeing right now. As the Democrats have raised issues, particularly in the area of foreign policy, it has raised doubts and concerns in the minds of a lot of people in the country, both left, right, and center, about the consistency of this administration's foreign policy and the efficacy of it.
So look ahead with this. Is foreign policy going to be the central issue in this campaign?
Well, I think it is a sort of the laydown issue. By that, I mean, assuming you were a poker player, that you have to usually, to get in a poker game, you have to ante up something just to get in the game. And I think that the Democratic candidate has to ante up credentials and some sense, communicate a sense to the American people that he has the strength to deal with this nasty world that we live in. And that's foreign policy in the minds of the vast majority of the American people. So it may ultimately turn on, assuming that Kerry can blunt, negate, and or seek advantage over Bush on that area. I think on the rest of the issues, the Democratic Party is where the vast majority of the American people are. And so that's why it's obvious to me the president would like to keep this on foreign policy, not just because he thinks that's his strong point, because he knows an incredibly weak point are jobs, the budget deficit, et cetera. And so, but I think it is more important in this election than any election since I have held public office and I got elected in 1972.
So let's just stick with foreign policy for the purposes of this conversation. I mean, there have been precious few moments in the last 3 years when someone has stopped me and said, gee, I wish the Democrats were in charge of keeping the nation safe at this point. If it becomes a question of national security, can the Democrats win on that issue?
Well, I think they can win on the issue of national security, particularly if Kerry's the standard bearer. But I think, again, the reason why we may win on that issue, to be very blunt about it, is in part because of the obvious failures of this administration on foreign policy. I mean, look, I have great respect for Mr. Brooks. I am a friend of his former editor, who comes in and has lunch with me not infrequently. And even the neoconservatives are a little upset with this administration in terms of the failure to follow through. You know, for the central tenet now is where democratization of that rough part of the world that threatens us is critically important. And yet the administration policy seems to be democratization on the cheap, whether we're talking about Afghanistan and or Iraq or any other part of the world. And there's this built-in reluctance in the Republican leadership in the administration to follow through. It goes back to the campaign assertions about no nation building. It's not a thing we do. Now, look, the Democrats are, I think, I've been very outspoken. Probably 20% of my party, maybe more, is basically pacifist. They are absolutely wedded to the notion of multilateral answers to everything, and they're not always multilateral answers to everything. But so both parties have weaknesses. But I think the focus, I think it's going to be Kerry on the offensive and the president on the defensive. So the president's going to have to spend some time, I think, explaining how he's going to do the things he asserts. And last point I'll make is there's not a single person. I doubt whether or not David and or Mr. Packer believe that we're not going to spend any more money on Iraq and or Afghanistan. Yet it's not in the budget at all. Now, I don't make that as a budget argument. I make that as a foreign policy argument that the rest of the world, I just got back from Europe. I spent time with Chirac. I spent time at the NAC, or NATO, with the permanent representatives. I met with the leaders of NATO and the European Union. And the question I kept getting was, are you guys going to stay? Are you guys really going to stay now? Look, while I'm trying to get NATO involved, while I'm trying to get a follow-on entity that the world will embrace to Bremer when he leaves in June, I'm over there making this case, and they're saying to me, "Look, wait a minute now. Are you guys really staying? I mean, you really haven't done what you said you're going to do in Afghanistan."
All right, but let's if we can just to wrap this up, bring it back to the question. Questions that will be put before the American people in an election, and forgive me for simplifying it down to bumper stickers, but the Republicans could print up preemption, we'll do it, war president, I am, freedom to the world. What would the bumper stickers for a Democratic foreign policy alternative would be? I'm listening to you, and it's sort of like multilateralism most of the time, but not all of the time. And
no, that's not my position.
But you're saying that's kind of the can that drags behind the party now.
Well, no, I think that is a can that drags behind the party. I think, in effect, I'm not very good at bumper stickers, but the bumper sticker of the Democrats are alone when necessary, better with the rest of the world. The idea that we're somehow going to be more secure in the world and going – look, the analogy I'd use is the one that was used by Mr. Packer in a recent article about World War II. Can you imagine these guys running World War II, post-World War II? The whole notion that we put together after World War II was we were, in relative terms, by far the most powerful nation in the world. We could have just decided we were going to use our force to dominate. Instead, we were smart enough to understand that our force was necessary to protect our interests, but it was absolutely critical in our long-term interest to make sure other people helped in the fight. And this is a fight against terrorism. Terrorism. My criticism of my friends in this administration are that they view terror as somehow totally state-sponsored. If you just go get the bad guys, if you take out Saddam, if you take out Kim Jong-il, if you take these guys out, terrorism goes away. It is not at all the problem. That is a problem, but that doesn't solve the issue of our greatest concern. And this is this war on terror. And the war on terror cannot be won any more than the war on communism could have been won, A, in a short period of time, B, alone without our allies.
Or with force alone.
Or C, without the force of arms. We need all of them.
Senator Biden, I have to stop you there. I need to bring in my other guests, but you've set us up well. I want to thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you.
Senator Joe Biden, ranking member on the Foreign Relations Committee. I mentioned earlier in the program we're now joined by George Packer. He's with us in a studio in New York City, staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. His article, A Democratic World, Can Liberals Take Foreign Policy Back from the Republicans, can be found in the current issue, or we have a link to it at our website. We are at www.theconnection.org. George, good of you to be with us.
It's good to be here.
David Brooks is also with us from the Christian Science Monitor Studios in Washington, D.C. David's an op-ed columnist for The New York Times, also senior editor at The Weekly Standard, contributing editor at Newsweek. David, nice to have you back.
Good to be with you.
Let's start, George Packer, with the piece that you wrote, because in many ways Senator Biden was using that example that you draw our attention to of the Second World War. The Democrats were very successful in the years after 1945 by taking advantage of that sort of multilateral involvement. They lost it. Can they regain it?
Well, it's a sad history, because Vietnam was the watershed for the Democratic Party. It turned a small number of Democrats into what became known as neoconservatives, who saw the Vietnam War not as an example of overreach and American might running up against its limits, but rather of American weakness and lack of political will. But a great many more Democrats, as Senator Biden pointed out, really became functional pacifists, if not doctrinal pacifists. And since Vietnam, with a few sort of intermittent and I would say rather erratic exceptions during the Clinton years, the leadership of the Democratic Party, and even more the base of the Democratic Party, has been uncomfortable with America's world leadership. And I don't think that the public is going to entrust national security to the party as long as that remains a perception. I think that was the key thing in the 2002 midterm election. The Democrats wanted to talk about prescription drugs.
I need a quick word here from David Brooks, because we're going to a break. David, if foreign affairs is central to this election, do the Democrats stand a chance?
Well, if you just look at the polls, the Republicans have a 30 or 40-point advantage on foreign affairs and national security. So that's a high mountain to climb.
But the 1st of July is ahead of us. Many, we have had now 2 days in a row where over 50 people have been killed by car bombs in Iraq. These issues aren't going to be marked up as successes for the Republicans.
Oh, no. Certainly there's a whole mess of trouble in Iraq, which the public is acutely concerned with. The question is, who has the better plan to go forward? You know, as you know, a lot of people, including myself, used to be Democrats and consider ourselves liberal on many social issues. But we stopped being Democrats because sometimes around the 70s, and I don't think it was Vietnam, I really think it was the Cold War, we decided that the Democratic Party, or the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, had rejected the Scoop Jackson wing, had rejected the wing that had a realistic view of the way the world really works, of the menace that really faced this country. And as culturally distant as we were from the Republicans, as weird as some of those Republicans seemed to us, we decided ultimately those people saw the world correctly.
Connection
and
listeners,
so reluctantly we're dragged over.
Connection listeners, we will be looking back. Was it the Cold War? Was it Vietnam? We'll be looking ahead at this election. Who has the better plan to move forward? Can the Democrats make up any of the ground in the ownership that the Republican Party has of security issues, of foreign affairs? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, we're looking ahead at the election before us and the issue of foreign policy and the struggle for supremacy there. My guests are George Packer. He is a staff writer at New Yorker magazine, author most recently of an article in the current issue called A Democratic World: Can Liberals Take Foreign Policy Back from the Republicans? David Brooks is with us from the Christian Science Monitor studios in Washington. He's an op-ed columnist for the New York Times and senior editor at the Weekly Standard. And if you think these two gentlemen aren't influential in their particular field, I can tell you we've managed to persuade Senator Joseph Biden to stay on and perhaps continue to participate in the conversation as we nudge this a little bit ahead. So, George and David, pull your chairs up to the front of the table here. I do want to stay a little bit with George and David for an understanding of how you see what is ahead. And George, let me come back to you. When you look at where the Democratic Party is lacking now, I may not be quoting you exactly right, but it is a lack of comfort with power that you point out in your article. Is that right?
That's a pretty good summation. That's the bad bumper sticker, or the tin can behind the bumper sticker. Yeah, I do think it goes back to Vietnam. I mean, in 1961, John F. Kennedy came into office promising to bear any burden and pay any price for liberty. And in 1972, George McGovern ran promising to bring America home. And what happened in between was Vietnam. And it just has cast such a long shadow over really my generation. I mean, I grew up during the Vietnam War. The 70s was when I sort of came of political age. All of my reflexes were against America's use of its power, especially its military power around the world. There was not an intervention that I supported until I was 34 years old and President Clinton sent the army into Haiti to restore a democratic president. I've rethought a lot of that, and I think that David Brooks is right, that the Republicans understood the world in a way that Democrats forgot they understood it in the 70s and in the 80s. But what we see now, I think, is in the Bush foreign policy, sort of exaggeration of that Republican view into something that's both too simplistic and too narrow. David wrote a very good column recently talking about the president, what the president would say if he could articulate his approach to the war. And it was to say, this is an ideological war. This is an existential war. It's about evil. All of that is true, but evil is sort of the starting point. It's not the end point. The question is, what do you do about it? And as Senator Biden said, this is a vast, complicated problem that isn't simply a matter of evildoers. It's a matter of an entire political culture that spans large parts of the Muslim world. And I don't think the administration's approach politically and ideologically has what it takes. They see it in narrow terms as eliminating evildoers rather than changing a political culture, which is a much harder thing to do, and which is why I think the Cold War is a good analogy for the fight that we're in now. Whether the Democrats can articulate an alternative that really is ambitious enough, as Senator Biden has been calling for, to keep America engaged in that part of the world, to do what it takes in Iraq, for starters, which is really the key place right now, I don't know. But I think that's the debate that they should be having.
David Brooks, how much of this is just an accident of timing? How much of this is the fact that in the late 1970s, with foreign policy adrift and Jimmy Carter fumbling the Iranian hostage crisis, Ronald Reagan happened to be there, the Republicans happened to be there, and using words like the evil empire? And then an accident of timing in September 11th, that a Republican president happened to be in place and able to react to what happened then? Or is there something more deep-seated here? Is there something that the Republicans bring to the table now that the Democrats cannot or do not?
I think there's something deep-seated. I've rooted for a lot of the things Senator Biden has been championing in the past several months for staying in Iraq, for building the nation properly, for putting more troops on the ground. But the problem I think many of us on the conservative side feel, first of all, the party as a whole does not feel the terror and security threat as deeply as it should. You go to a John Edwards event, it's a great event, he doesn't mention terrorism. You look at the exit polls in the last, say, 10 or 12 Democratic primaries, primary voters in the Democratic Party listed terror and security as the last issue when asked what issue is most important to them, you know, eighth or ninth. And that raises concerns. But I do think there is a deep fundamental split between the two ideologies or the two parties on how we look at the world. I think The Democratic Party, since McGovern, has become a party that tends to see the world, or aims for a world, which is Lockean, a world in which we can have a global government of global cooperation, global institutions, where we can all, you know, cooperate. I think Republicans have more realistically seen the world as more Hobbesian, as a world that is inevitably filled with conflict, inevitably filled with people who really do want to destroy us. And as nice as it would be to have a Lockean world of world government, that's simply not realistic. And I think as a result of that basic worldview, conservatives have been more responsible at looking at the Soviet Union and now looking at the ideological threat of Islamic totalitarianism.
Senator Biden, let me take David Brooks' argument one step further. I mean, he says in his writing that it really took the Republicans coming into office to say, Kyoto Accord, what is this? You know, everybody signed it. Nobody's going to do anything about it. Let's just get out of it. And he uses that as an example for a willingness that the Republican Party has to, you know, elbow aside the feel-good multilateralism that seems to trip the Democrats more often than not.
Well, I think we're in a period of transition here, to state the obvious. I mean, so much has changed. I think when our kids are writing their senior thesis about, you know, how well did we handle things at the turn of the 21st century and what were the major problems facing the world at the time, the kid who writes the paper that has the title, why were they surprised they didn't have a policy? The whole world's changed. I mean, the wall's down. Terrorism is a real thing. We were never threatened by anyone before other than a nation state. And at the same time, Europe's been preoccupied with its own unification and looking inward. And so I think a lot of this is transition. If you take a look at the fits and starts of the Clinton administration dealing with the Balkans, I mean, I was the pain in the neck here in the United States Senate. It wasn't Bob Dole. It wasn't John McCain who initially said we should use force in the Balkans. It was Joe Biden, and the Republicans fought it. Look at the Republicans, how they took me on every single time when I talked about the need to stay in Kosovo, the need to use air power. We couldn't even get a vote here in the United States Senate, blocked by the Republicans, on the use of force. Their argument was we're violating the sovereignty of Serbia. So they're going through a transition as well. But I think that David makes a very good point about this Lockean and Hobbesian view. The truth of the matter is that both parties are in transition here. If you take David's point about Kyoto, he gets half of it right. With all due respect, David, you're right that there is, in fact, we did not sign on to Kyoto. Now, the part you don't get right is there is a friggin' global warming problem. It is gigantic. It is not soluble by the United States alone, and it is totally incapable of solution without the United States being the one to bring about a deal. So you guys feel real good, and you love this talk about being Hobbesian, but you are subjecting me to that Hobbesian world by your refusal to do anything to deal with global warming. You're guaranteeing my kids are in trouble. You're guaranteeing that my grandchildren and great-grandchildren are doomed in the long term here.
All right, let's hear from David Brooks here on that friggin' global warming problem.
Right, it is a friggin' problem.
I'm a little off the friggin' reservation. I do think there's a serious global warming problem, and I think that's sort of a side issue of this main debate.
I would like to see
us do something about it. But I, you know, from where I sit, I'd love to see Joe Biden run and George Packer run the nation building. You know, the Republicans come very slowly to nation building. They came, as Senator Biden predicts, slowly to Kosovo, to a sort of human rights intervention. I'd love to see them run that because, in some ways, democratic instincts are stronger when it comes to building a nation, building civil society, building schools and things like that. My problem is that when it comes to confronting evil, which has to be done with military force, somehow the Republican Party always seems to take the lead, which is, I think, why people like Paul Wolfowitz, who started out working for Scoop Jackson, people like Elliot Abrams, who's also in the administration, the same thing, ultimately decided that, you know, while they might not agree with the Republicans on everything, they do support nation building. Ultimately, the conservative side of the spectrum had the more realistic view. You had to start from there and then try to improve it with the superior democratic ideas on nation building.
All right, Connection listeners, who are you going to call? Who do you trust to manage foreign policy? 1-800-423-8255. Durham, North Carolina. And Doug, you're with us. Go ahead.
Hi, Dick. Thanks. I really love the show. I just wanted to say I consider myself kind of a left-leaning independent, and I feel like there's more to national security than just who has the bigger army. I think in the past, you know, when it just came down to military support, increasing the army or decreasing the army, the Republicans might have had the better had the edge because they were always for the bigger army, but that these days foreign policy has so much more to do with the kind of relationships that we make. And mm-hmm. I think that we're kind of ignoring the lessons we've learned by making deals with people like Saddam Hussein or with governments like the Shah of Iran, that these things come back to bite us in the rear end, and we just can't go around invading all these countries every time something goes wrong. And I feel like a democratic president with a strong military background might be a little bit more pragmatic, but still try and do some long-term planning to try and encourage more democracy and human rights and things in the Middle East that'll keep these terrorists from coming up and prevent revolutions from happening. I'm really concerned about what might happen in Pakistan or Saudi Arabia or a country like that if these oppressed people decide they're going to have a revolution and, like Iran, you know, target all their animosity to the United States. You know, you don't have to defeat the United States militarily.
Doug, I want to pass this over to George Parker, if you don't mind, because George, he's making the argument that you're making in saying where you think the Republicans are dropping the ball and where the Democrats can fill in that gap by spending more on aid, less on guns, and being willing to sort of stay in theater a little longer.
He's making about half of the argument that I make. In my middle years, I've come to appreciate the good effects of a big army. In fact, we should have gone into Iraq with a bigger army, not a smaller one, because we couldn't secure the country after the war, and that was one of the serious flaws of the Rumsfeld planning effort. But I mean, the caller is absolutely right that Pakistan and Saudi Arabia are just terrifying situations. I don't think either party knows exactly what to do about them. I mean, in Pakistan, we've got a dictator who has been consolidating power. There's no way you can look at Pakistan and saying it's moving in a democratic direction. On the other hand, he seems to be our best bet and maybe our only bet in preventing the Islamists within the military and in that society from coming to power and, God forbid, taking control of Pakistan's nuclear arsenal. I don't think either party really knows what to do about that. We've sort of allowed it to drift. And now we've got the bad news that that the Pakistanis have been selling nuclear secrets. So, the other half of what he says is what I think, namely that the war on terrorism is partly a military war, but it's also partly a war of changing these cultures, and that partly has to happen through aid, through public diplomacy, through our own civil society being involved. And that's where I really do fault the president. He has not summoned Americans to this cause. He has made it the cause of our volunteer soldiers and of policymakers in Washington. After September 11th, he had an opportunity that he lost to make this a national cause, to really call Americans in a Roosevelt or Truman or Kennedy style to a greater thing. And I think I've read David saying something similar, that on domestic policy, there's a weird disconnect between the idealism of the president's foreign policy and the fairly tired status quo of his domestic policy. And I think they're linked. And I think the foreign policy requires a more idealistic domestic policy in everything from energy policy to tax fairness to not extending the crony capitalism of Washington mm-hmm. to Iraq, which is what's happened. I think those are ideological questions that are a weakness in the Republicans' foreign policy. They begin in their domestic policy.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. David Brooks, you look at the president's words, "I am a war president." He's not saying we are a people at war. That's the point that George Packer is making about not bringing people along necessarily, telling them to go shopping instead of sort of participate in whatever they could do to be more a civic part of that. Is that a weakness in the Republican push forward in the last 3 years?
Yeah, it certainly is. And it's something that may come back to bite the president. He is a war president. I believe he's living really in September 12th. For him, the urgency of September 11th is just as present as it ever was.
Right.
Every morning he wakes up and gets that briefing, and he feels the menace. The problem is, if you cover the Democratic campaign as I did, the September 11th really was a distant event. It just was not talked about very much, as I mentioned. John Edwards doesn't mention it at all. And I think that's also true on the conservative side, by the way. I think a lot of people have decided terror and security are not a main threat. They'd rather talk about spending or immigration or something like that. And so there's a lot of discontent on both sides. There's a gap between Bush and the country, I think. And I think it's a gap that's sort of reminiscent of the gap between society and the military, which is a wide cultural gap. And I think that's actually the biggest threat to George Bush's reelection.
And Senator Biden, if the president stands at a podium during the election and says, "This country is in danger, I am here to make sure that we focus on minimizing that danger. That's going to be an extremely potent image for the Democrats to try and assault.
Well, I think that's true, but I don't think he can say that with much credibility in most people's minds. Look, I think David made a very important point a moment ago. The truth of the matter is both conservatives and Republicans and moderate and liberal Democrats have shied away from what the hardest thing they have to do. This is going to cost us a lot more time and a lot more money and a lot more allocation of our resources. The only way a president can lead, in my view, is to stand up and say, we are a country under siege. I need your help. I am a war president. Let me tell you what we must do. We must, in fact, see to it that Afghanistan is stable. Otherwise, Pakistan will fall, and they have over 100 million people in nuclear weapons. We must, in fact, succeed in Iraq, and that's going to require me to do two things, not only get more help from the international community, but apply more resources. And ladies and gentlemen, we can't do everything. I am going to have to ask you to forego some of your tax cut, forego some of the social programs. Otherwise, the American public scratches their head. David, there's a reason why people aren't listing terrorism as the single greatest threat. President gives us the largest tax cut in the history of the United States, wants to give us more of a tax cut, has a $500 billion deficit, says he's a war president, and people go, okay, I got it. Tell me, where's the war? What's the war? He looks like he's trying to get out of Iraq. He's not doing what needs to be done in Afghanistan. He talks about how he's going to be tough. He has no plan for North Korea. He doesn't know what the hell he's doing with regard to Pakistan. And all of a sudden they go, what's the problem here?
David, a quick word from you before we go to a break here.
A little Republican pushback.
Yeah.
The biggest difference between the electorates of the two parties is that Republican voters, if you look at every poll, rank terrorism at the top or second in their concerns about the country, and Democratic voters rank it at the bottom or second to last. Republican voters are aware of terrorism. Democratic voters, for some reason, want to think about other things, and there are other important issues, but that is just a huge difference between the bases of the two parties.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. What could the Democrats do to create a foreign policy that would make that party not only relevant but noticeable and distinct from the way the Republicans have set the table for this election? Are you still more inclined to trust Republicans when it comes to national security? Are you one of those people? You think the Democrats could ever return to the foreign policy standing that they enjoyed in the days of FDR, Truman, and Kennedy? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We're talking about foreign policy, the fight for that in the election. Ahead with us, the writers David Brooks and George Packer, Senator Joseph Biden, ranking member on the Foreign Relations Committee, 1-800-423-8255 to Acton, Massachusetts. Now, Mary, you're joining us. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I first want to say I am so pleased to have just heard Senator Biden say what I've been waiting for some of the Democratic leaders to say as forcefully as he did. We were talking earlier about sound bites, and I think one of the things that concerns me with the Democrats is that we are perceived as a wishy-washy group who has a hard time towing the line. I would like
perceived as that, Mary, or actually is that?
Excuse me?
Are you saying the Democrats are perceived to be that way, or they actually are that way?
Hard to tell sometimes. But I think my point here is what I would love to see the Democrats coming out with, and I think Kerry could do this, is to emphasize the fact that, yes, there are times when we have to go to war. However, unlike President Bush, we need to go to war maximizing our success and minimizing our risk. We need to go in with a plan. And it has become so evident that that was not the case with Bush. I don't think that Kerry will be called on his vote for this war from the Democrats or called wishy-washy from the Republicans if he's able to say there's a time and a place, but if we're going to do it, we're going to do it right, and we're going to have long-term plans, such as Senator Biden mentioned. That's what I'm waiting to hear, and I think that will counter a lot of the jingoist things that I hear coming out of President Bush's mouth.
Mary, I'm going to go to the senator in just a minute, but I want to start with George Packer, because, George, you did a little bit of history in the research for your New Yorker article, and I just wonder what you found in the dog-eared handbook of FDR and Truman that would be still relevant today. Have the Democrats walked away from something that could still be relevant and important?
Well, I think FDR and Truman had actually rather different foreign policies, but they had complementary ones. What FDR was able to do was to articulate for the public why this was a national cause, what we were fighting against, what we were fighting for, why it was really about democracy. It was about security, but it was also about something higher. It was about democracy, which is something President Bush talks about. But for some reason, the language he uses and perhaps the tone he uses doesn't have the same effect. It doesn't seem to be capable of persuading either vast numbers of Americans or, more importantly, people around the world. That's really what this is about. What Truman did was to sort of turn that high rhetoric into very practical policies in which these international institutions, some of which have been much maligned and justly so in recent years, such as the UN, but also NATO, which was really a much more effective alliance, to use those to harness our power, as Senator Biden said earlier, not to tell the rest of the world, you know, we'll go it alone because we can. In fact, our relative power was greater after World War II in some ways economically, and also we had the bomb and no one else did, than it is now. Instead, Truman was wise enough, along with Acheson and the other early Cold Warriors of the Liberal Democrats, to see that our power would be magnified by our interrelationships with other democracies. And recently, David's colleague Robert Kagan from the Weekly Standard wrote an afterword to his famous book on Mars and Venus, in which he said, sort of looking back at the Iraq War, the problem here is that we have created a divide between America and its liberal democratic allies. And that's a profound problem, because if we're fighting for anything, it's for liberal democracy. So we cannot be divided from the other liberal democracies of the world. And I think, as much as President Bush has achieved in overthrowing two of the worst regimes in modern history, it's come at this very high cost of isolating us. And I don't think that's a long-term strategy
for success. Senator Biden, one of the things that John Kerry said that he would do first if he were elected president is go to all the allies and say, hey, we are rejoining the world community. Do you think that that's what people in this country want to hear from a president or a prospective president?
I don't know whether they want to hear it. I would say it differently. I say he should go to all the allies and say, look, here's our position. This is why we think we're right. And we want you to join us, and we're willing to change some of what we've been doing. We're not going to project power without having staying power. There should be no conflict without post-conflict planning. And the reason why, with all due respect, the president can't make the case, in my view, why this is a national cause, is the rationale he offers, the people intuitively know, is not true. The reason why it's important to win in Iraq is complicated. It's because if we do not, you will see Iran's power in the region expand exponentially. You will see the end of any notion of modernity in the Arab world in the next decade. You will see any instincts toward democratization crumble. You will see Turkey reconsider with its Islamist, with its government that's a secular but Islamic party looking east instead of west. You will see Pakistan, if Afghanistan falls, beginning to reconsider whether or not they should be in this fight. Instead, the president uses a bromide. He says, unless we fight them in Baghdad, we'll have to fight them in Boston. That is pure malarkey. They intuitively know it. We had to fight them in Baghdad. I supported us going in and fighting in Baghdad because I thought he had a broader view of what was needed in the region. But that is defunct. It doesn't exist. And last point, I have to go vote. Last point is, I admit, the Democratic Party has not yet been willing to flat out state what we have to do to prevail against this new totalitarianism. It is a it is a terror that is driven by and can only ultimately be beaten by this conflict over ideas. That's where David is right. This is a major, major, major undertaking. And I admit to you that every time I stand up in the Democratic caucus and talk about the need to have more forces in Iraq, even if we can't get the rest of the world to join us, when I talk about having to spend at the president's request, I put together an initiative called Initiative 9/11, calling for spending $500 million on the whole notion of public diplomacy in the region. Everybody in my caucus goes, oh, geez, you know, no. And at the same hand, the president is not leveling. And so neither party's really leveling here, and that's what I mean by this is a transition period we're going through, and it's going to be up to Kerry as the nominee to articulate his willingness to use force if need be, but understand that it makes sense, as Kagan points out, not to alienate the rest of the liberal democracies in the world unless we must.
Senator Biden, I know you've got to go, and I want to thank you for...
I apologize.
No, it's all right. It was good to have you hanging around on the program.
All right.
You're welcome anytime.
Thank you. Thanks,
Senator Joseph Biden, ranking member on the Foreign Relations Committee. Now, David Brooks, I'm asking you to do some fairly heavy lifting here, but I thought maybe we could... go back to what George Packer was saying earlier about whether or not Bush can be persuasive in using the words that he uses by actually listening to the president himself. Once again, from NBC's Meet the Press.
I've got a foreign policy that is one that believes America has a responsibility in this world to lead. A responsibility to lead in the war against terror. A responsibility to speak clearly about the threats that we all face. A responsibility to promote freedom, to free people.
And David Brooks, the George is saying that the words aren't sticking, that the words aren't being heard. You disagree fundamentally with that?
No, but it's not our fault. I do agree with the president that the United States is an exceptional nation with a mission to spread freedom around the world.
Right.
And I believe that everyone would like to do it with as many allies as possible. And John Kerry always talks about internationalizing the conflict. The problem is the president has to deal with the real world as it really is. And the government of France decided their primary national interest was not in promoting democracy in the Middle East. It was in girdling the uber power of the United States. The countries like Russia and China were not that enthusiastic about democracy in the Middle East. They're not that enthusiastic about democracy in any case. And there are plenty of other countries around the world that just don't think democracy in the Middle East is realistic. And so you had a whole series of nations deciding that it was in their national interest not to promote this war, but really to where the main problem they faced was a dominant United States, and they were going to oppose us no matter what. So the choice the president faced was not multilateralism or unilateralism. It was a choice of acting with as many nations as possible or not acting at all. And that's the realistic choice. And, you know, I've been listening to Democrats for the past couple months in Iowa and New Hampshire, and that's the choice that I never hear them confronting. How do you handle a Russia and a France and a China that were simply implacably opposed to the sort of policies, you know, that we were championing?
You wrote a piece in the New York Times called Bush on Bush Take Two. It was what he perhaps ought to have said if he had your facility with the language. I think that's sort of the way you preface it. In fact,
you're laying bare the megalomania of that column. Thank you.
Well, it's well written, and in fact, we'll have a link to it at our website because it's expressing in part a frustration that you have that maybe the man in charge can't express the ideas that he wants to express.
Well, listen, if I sat and watched Meet the Press, I thought he did fine. Many of my friends, including on the conservative side, thought he did terribly if you wanted to move to New Zealand. But, you know, he's not someone who comes in and gives you five or six arguments. He gives you the same argument over and over again. Nonetheless, I do think that he agrees with George Packer. He does see this as an ideological fight against a broad, hateful ideology that has to be addressed fundamentally. And I think that's why he made the leap from al-Qaeda to Iraq, because he had to fundamentally transform the Middle East. His administration talks of a generational challenge. In George's New Yorker piece, he quotes Ivo Dalder from the Brookings Institution saying the Republicans don't see it this way. But I think fundamentally they see it very much that way, as a broad war against a hostile ideology which has descended from Nazism, really.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. George Packer, your turn here. The one quibble that you would have, if I'm not mistaken, is that Bush has badly framed the war by calling it a war on terror.
Well, I think that the word terrorism, obviously, that's the That's the effect that we're fighting, but it's not the cause that we're fighting. And it leads to confusion because terrorism is a worldwide phenomenon. It occurs in different guises in places as diverse as Spain and Sri Lanka. But Spain and Sri Lanka are not the problem here. The problem is what Joschka Fischer, the German foreign minister, calls Islamist totalitarianism. David and I agree. That's what it is. It's almost global. It seems to have taken deep root in the minds of millions of especially young people and especially in repressive Islamic countries around the world. But now that I've mentioned Joschka Fischer, something from the week's news just as a reply to what David said. I agree with most of what he said, especially about the Democrats' unwillingness to face those tough questions. Mm-hmm. But Rumsfeld went to Europe recently and spoke to European officials and business leaders. And he simply declared, we were right and you were wrong. I'm shocked that any of you could have been on the other side. It was a classic Rumsfeld performance of assertion. And too much of the Bush foreign policy seems to be simply a matter of assertion, which is why it alienates people who might be brought over by more supple means. Joschka Fischer at the same meeting stood up and said, what we really need is an American and European alliance to try to democratize the Middle East and to bring it into the modern world. My guess is that's going to go nowhere, and partly because the resonant effect of that meeting was what Rumsfeld said. For this policy of fighting an ideology to be in the hands of the Office of the Secretary of Defense mm-hmm. and the Vice President's office, I think has been disastrous because, in a way, those conservatives are not of David's ilk. I don't think they see America's role in the world in the same way. They are more classic realists who have come to a new sense of our power and how it can be used. But I don't think they have the idealism that David has, and their actions and policies haven't expressed it. So perhaps part of the problem is simply our foreign policy is in the wrong hands. It may be the right idea, but it's in the wrong hands.
If I could just say I disagree with this, was a meeting at Verkunde in Munich. And I think Joschka Fischer also said, we're right and you were wrong. I think both sides have agreed to say, we're right, you were wrong. And then after they said that, which is important to them, then they move on and talk about a broad agenda for democracy in the Middle East. I think there's a lot of good news coming out of what's happening in the world today, that there's a general consensus, let's be constructive together. And we all agree about democratizing the Middle East. And I think that the Office of the Vice President and the Defense Department are foremost in working toward that.
Yes, and yet it seems that we can never get past the we are right and you're wrong, and I've yet to see the truly constructive work taking place, and this is a relationship of codependency, and I think the disastrous diplomacy leading up to the Iraq war was a codependent case on both sides, and in a sense they brought out the worst in each other. It seems to me they continue to do so.
And looking ahead, will the notion of democratizing the Middle East be central to both parties in their presentation of their foreign policy in the election to come? We'll certainly be speaking more about that, and I hope again with George Packer and David Brooks. Thanks to both of you for being with me on the program today.
Thank you very much.
George Packer, staff writer for The New Yorker, David Brooks, op-ed columnist for The New York Times. Earlier in the program, we also talked with Senator Joe Biden, Democratic senator from Delaware, ranking member on the Foreign Relations Committee. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.